Apologies for the ads. As an independent one-woman show, ads help me recover some of my costs. If you want to skip the ads, sign up to the exclusive feed. All episodes are free from ads, and there's full-length bonus episodes as well. The link is in the show notes. You can also make a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/amillionOTW. And on with the show, as they say. Welcome back to my examination of the death of Cindy James. Where we left off, Cindy has recently separated from Roy and started receiving ominous and threatening phone calls. Constable Patrick McBride has moved in with her to protect her, but moved out a month later, and then in January 1983, she has been found unconscious and claiming to have been sexually assaulted in her garage, and the police are starting to find Cindy to be the suspicious one.
Cindy changed her name, unlisted her phone number, and moved from Vancouver to Richmond. But no matter what she did, the harassment continued.
This is probably the most baffling case that I've ever come across. One that's kept me awake at nights. I know anybody who's come across this case, the jurors, the coroner's people, police officers who I've talked to, everybody has lain awake at night thinking, can this be? Can somebody have done this to themselves? Can somebody be out there lurking still and have never been caught?
They will be trying to find out if she was murdered or if she committed suicide.
The question is, how do you tie your hands behind your own back and then kill yourself?
And they're willing to keep investigating, but I don't think they're ever going to find a killer. I now believe it's a suicide.
I believe it's a murder, yes.
Days after her assault, Cindy decides she can't live at her house anymore. It's too risky. So on February 1st, she moved in temporarily with Roy again in West Vancouver. But the notes continued, and she got one at his place saying, "Run, rabbit, run. I'll show you how fucking good I am. Soon, bang, bang, you're dead." The calls also continued to ring at Roy's, often with Roy standing right there, and Roy also had an answering machine. Now, this is the one and kind of the only recording of the phone calls that I could find. I don't know the timing specifically on this one, like what year it was, but it is a little creepy nonetheless. Cindy moved out of Roy's in April of 1983 and did not give her personal information out to anyone. She also started to carry pepper spray and a personal panic button around with her everywhere she went. And that summer, Roy said that she needed a break, and she obviously really did. So by this time, she had started to lose weight. She was just kind of shell-shocked looking, and so he sent her to Indonesia to visit one of her brothers that was stationed there. And nothing happened to her on that trip, so she came back refreshed, ready to figure this crap out. She had her car painted a different color to try and disguise it. She changed her hair, but then she received another note at her new house saying, "Welcome back." In October, Cindy came home from work to find a dead cat in her yard, strangled with a rope around its neck with a note stuck to it saying, "You're next." Then her garden was completely trashed. She didn't tell police or anyone about this particular incident, but she wrote in her diary, where she detailed all and every incident, that she suspected Roy about the garden because he had done that to her once when they were married. She had always loved gardening, and he had done it to sort of punish her about something back then. But she was still maintaining at this time, kind of publicly, that Roy wasn't and couldn't be her stalker. In November, Patrick found another note on Cindy's front porch, and then another dead and strangled cat, again with a rope around its neck. Later that month, a third cat was found, but this one had been run over by a car, but was found in her garden. And then at Patrick's insistence, who realized that the police weren't really taking her seriously, she hired a private investigator named Ozzie Caban to investigate this stalker. And in fact, after her death, her family found her personal diaries that she had written during this time, that she felt she was, in addition to being like stalked, like in danger stalked, she was psychologically and emotionally being abused by not just the stalker, but also by the police. Ozzie was paid by Cindy over the next 6 years, and he believes there was, in fact, a stalker. He equipped her with a two-way radio, and then the phone calls and notes continued. At this point, both the notes and the calls were being received at her work as well as her home. Some of the notes were mailed, some of them were just dropped off at her house. But one of her coworkers did take one of these calls, but it was another one of those silent calls. Ozzie, although he believed Cindy was being stalked and terrorized, he did feel from the very beginning that Cindy was withholding information from him, almost like she kind of knew who was doing it but refused to say. Now, Tilly, her mom, always felt it was because she was scared out of her mind of the repercussions, because they, of course, threatened her family. But if that was entirely true, then I'm not really sure why she involved the police at all. I mean, I guess it kind of explains starting the romantic relationship with a police officer, but she did call them after each incident herself. On January 30th, 1984, Ozzie heard some strange sounds on the two-way radio that he gave to Cindy. He described them as crackling sounds, but Cindy didn't respond. Now, I'm not an expert on these things, but I think two-way radios are what we used to call walkie-talkies. And if that's the case, you have to push the button and hold the button in order for anyone to hear you or anything from your channel. But they are subject to interference, so that could have been it as well. But regardless, Ozzie was so concerned that he headed over to her place. And he came into the house to find Cindy on her living, some say living room floor, some say kitchen floor, completely unconscious, with a knife stabbed right through her hand, pinning a note. And again, this was another one of those notes made from newspaper letters. It would have taken some time to make the note, and it said, "Now you must die, C word."
I didn't know what I had, so I kicked the door in and entered. I found blood in the kitchen. I found her lying in the hallway where the radio was. I checked for pulse. As far as I was concerned, she was dead. I saw the knife through her hand. There was a note on the knife stating, "You're dead, bitch," or something along that line. Nobody could have done that to themselves.
This time at the hospital, she was able to give a little bit of information about the man, but the police sketch that she gave was pretty generic. A man maybe in his early 40s with dark brown hair, parted on the side and coming just below his ears. He had rather high cheekbones, large eyes with narrow eyebrows. He told police and Ozzie that the last thing that she remembered was seeing a man come through her back gate into her property before being hit over the head with some kind of blunt object, and that he had put a needle in her arm and then she was knocked out. The doctors did find a needle mark in her right arm, but there was no traces of anything in her system. One of the police officers also noted that there was these circular drag marks of blood on the kitchen floor, like someone had been trying to clean up a bit. At this point, Cindy was given a polygraph, and depending on who's telling the story, she either passed it outright or it was inconclusive. So if we go with inconclusive, it doesn't mean that she was lying. It just means that it wasn't a very valid test. And we all know that polygraphs can be up to the eye of the beholder and aren't exactly admissible in court. They can also be passed by believing strongly enough in your own lies. So I guess we can't really consider that as evidence of anything. And the blood cleanup and needle marks are also one of those, it depends on who you ask things. She could have done both herself, and the drugs could have been something that is eliminated from the system really quickly. However, stabbing yourself with a paring knife at the same time making sure that the note is attached squarely and evenly without tearing or having neighbors overhear your screams is a little bit of a stretch. If you're starting to think that Cindy had dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder, that's probably a good guess if you're on the side that thinks that she was doing these things to herself. But they don't normally self-harm, like you don't bite the hand that feeds you, or the host, as it were. And the majority of patients with dissociative identity disorder describe it more like watching a video game of yourself, not like the way TV and movies portray it, with completely separate alters that are unaware of what each persona is doing. And this particular incident is one of the more sort of head-scratchy ones, because it's hard to pin 100% on her or 100% for sure on someone else. Again, because there's just no concrete evidence that anyone else had been there at the time to have done it. But it's an odd thing for her to have done to herself. Now, in most of the reports on this case, it is told that Patrick or Ozzy or the police, someone, installed cameras in her house. Why they didn't catch anything, I don't know if that was really true, because they either would have seen someone approaching the house or her doing something, but maybe they weren't installed inside the house or they missed the backyard, but I think missing the backyard would be kind of stupid. So my feeling is that there was no cameras and no one for whatever reason thought that that might be a good idea. The police still feeling she was not being truthful. They didn't even bother to take fingerprints this time, which seems unprofessional at best. There were no signs of forced entry, which is a little weird because she says that she saw him approaching the house, and you'd think with everything going on in her life, opening the door for the person would be out of the question. Unless she recognized him, but as like someone who was like a friend, not her tormentor, or he was never there. And now here's another thing that I find kind of strange. If the police didn't believe her, but had come to investigate each and every time, and they were already complaining about the taxpayer money and all the resources they were using, well, then why didn't they put their investigative efforts into catching Cindy in the act if they were so convinced that she was doing this herself? After all, faking crimes is a crime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
But not every officer on the force was against Cindy. There were some that believed that Roy had to be the one doing or organizing all of this. When Cindy got out of the hospital, she installed an alarm system. And at this time, she was living on Clay and Smith in Richmond. And right next door lived her coworker, Tammy Carmen, and her husband, Colin. And what is kind of interesting about Tammy's recollection is that she says that for the first 6 months or so, she was living next door to them. There really wasn't any commotion. But later in that same interview says that when the alarm was first installed, it was going off all the time, like almost nightly, and that eventually the neighbors stopped coming out of their houses to investigate. But Tammy and Colin always came out. Tammy also said that she didn't know anything about all these previous attacks and that she was being stalked. But Tammy was a coworker of hers, so she had to have known because it was this small team of people, and notes and calls were coming to her work, as well as the police were telling them that they didn't think anyone else was in danger besides Cindy. So that's a little confusing to me. Tammy does say that Cindy was definitely frightened and that she saw the police being very dismissive of her. In February 1984, Cindy started to change her tune a little bit and started to tell the police that, in fact, she was suspecting Roy of being behind it because he had been abusive during their marriage. And the police agreed with her on that. I think they all kind of wondered all along if somebody was really doing this to her, and that it was probably Roy or somebody that Roy had hired. But other times she would tell the police that she was sure she'd seen this person who wasn't Roy out and about, but that he wasn't always alone. And then at some point she told the police that she did recognize the person, but she was too afraid to give his name. And again, this kind of goes against why she's calling the police at all if she's worried about telling on him. And why continue to go to the police when they clearly aren't even believing her? Like, you would think hiring Ozzy to investigate and try to keep her safe would be the way she would want to go. Like, keep it low-key rather than all-out alarms and police. The police did question Roy more than once, but he always had an alibi when the events happened. Otto, Cindy's dad, was more convinced that it was Roy, though, and he agreed to wear a wire and talk to him. He met with him in March of 1984 at a donut shop for coffee and basically told him, stay the hell away from my daughter, and told him to stop any further contact with her. And after which, Roy wrote this 6-page letter to Otto, which has never actually been revealed in detail, but laid out his theory, apparently, that the mafia was behind it all. He said Cindy had pissed off some relative of this powerful and dangerous family, and that had started kind of everything off. And if Otto was smart, he'd be making the police investigate that angle. Cindy's theory was that whoever it was didn't want to kill her, but rather scare her to death by terrorizing her until she lost her mind, which appeared at this point to be working. Cindy was at this point just an absolute shell of her former self. She'd become paranoid. She stopped socializing and going out much. And of course, she lost quite a bit of weight. At the end of March, Cindy is asked to take another polygraph test. And this time she passes. And the conclusion is that all the information supplied by Cindy was completely truthful. And by the summer of 1984, things started to snowball for Cindy even more. The calls were near daily and always too short to really get any trace on. And the police did set up some surveillance using 14 police officers to switch shifts. Cindy knew about the surveillance, but no one else did. And they would station themselves outside the neighbor's yard and then watch the house 24 hours a day, and nothing happened, like, at all. But as soon as they would gather up, shop, and leave, Cindy would be on the phone to the police about a note or another phone call. Her family believed it was because whoever it was knew she was being watched and wanted her not to be believed. But the police pretty much straight up didn't believe her. I mean, they believed things were happening and that she wasn't working alone, but that for some reason and somehow she had convinced someone to help her appear to be being stalked and harassed. On the 18th of June, Ozzy got a panicked phone call from Cindy that she was hiding in the bushes in her garden because someone was in the house. Ozzy rushed over and found Heidi, Cindy's dog, hiding and cowering in the basement with a rope tied like a noose around its neck and a note saying happy birthday along with some rather explicit pornographic pictures. Heidi had been physically abused and was terrified and shaking. And Ozzy felt that the rope on Heidi was very similar to the ones that were found around the cat's necks that had been found dead. He also found a cigarette butt on one of the basement windowsills that was not the same as the brand that Cindy smoked. Ozzy felt very strongly that there is no way in heck that Cindy abused Heidi. That was not Cindy. She had never abused an animal in her entire life. Heidi was a well-loved and well-taken care of little doggo. Another reporting in the same story, though, is that Heidi was found tied to the kitchen table. It's just, I think, another example of how is anyone supposed to get to the truth with all of these small little inconsistencies that could result in one very huge inconsistency. That same month, Ozzy answered one of the calls himself, and when Cindy wasn't home, so more proof, I guess, that these calls were real. Another dead cat was found in the stairwell, and it doesn't clarify if it was a stairwell inside or outside of her house. On the 1st of July, Cindy got a knock on the door, and surprisingly again, she opened it, and there was two men saying that they were police. Well, I mean, Cindy knew by this time every officer in Richmond and most of Vancouver. So she used the two-way radio she had to call Ozzy, and as soon as she did that, she says these two guys took off. and one of Cindy's coworkers got a call at her work saying, "Get rid of the big pig." On July 9th, Cindy's mom, Tilly, was actually staying over, and in the middle of the night, they were both awoken by Heidi barking wildly, and when Tilly got up to investigate, she found Cindy running around frantically checking the doors and windows. Then the doorbell rang, which they both heard. They didn't open the door, but they saw the small window that was next to the door that kind of looks out to the front porch was cracked. On July 23rd, Cindy radioed Ozzy to tell him that she was taking Heidi for a walk by Dunbar Park around 8:30 that night. And he said, "You know, you're crazy to go anywhere alone, Cindy." And she said she would be fine. She just needed the fresh air. Well, around midnight, she rang the doorbell of this random house, collapsed on their front porch as soon as they opened the door. She had, this time it was a dark gray pair of nylons tied around her neck. She was taken to the British Columbia Health and Sciences Center. The doctors again found two puncture marks on her right arm. But again, there were no actual drugs besides her antidepressants that she'd been prescribed that were in her system. She told the police that while she was walking Heidi, a green van had pulled beside her with a bearded man driving, which is different than the sketch drawing she had provided the year before. And there was a female passenger in the van, and they had asked her for directions, and she just didn't remember anything really after that. Ozzy was able to find Heidi wandering alone in Dunbar Park. Interestingly, the hospital's reception received a call while Cindy was there asking about their security protocol. This wigged out the receptionist who reported it, and when the police played a recording of Roy's voice, she said it maybe could have been him, but she wasn't sure. Ozzy suggested that Cindy should consider going under hypnosis to see if maybe she could remember any other details, but it wasn't working for her, and the therapist said that she was likely too freshly traumatized for it to work. The police lead detective Chris Bornerud told Ozzy and Cindy at this point that they had interviewed and done background checks on all of her coworkers, her friends, family, pretty much anyone she knew. They had ruled out all of the current and former patients and her families and had even done an Interpol search on Roy. They had no leads whatsoever. So Cindy and Ozzy decided that they would give this hypnosis another go as kind of their only option. And this time she was able to be put under and came up with a rather shocking memory, which I have to leave for next time. We are still only 2 years in. The story goes on until 1989, so there's lots more craziness to go through. It's going to be interesting, at least for me, to see where I land on my theory at the end, which will probably be in a couple more episodes. I don't think I can finish this in one more. There's just way too much to dive into. So I hope that you've really been enjoying this series so far, and I'm going to be back to my regular episodes soon if you haven't been. I do have to do my June installment of Intimate Partner Homicides, so there might be a break in the Cindy James series on a Monday for that. So just keep listening, even if you're bored with this story already. Most of you are falling asleep to my voice anyways, so it's fine. I read my comments and my emails. I know my audience. I do it too all the time. I put on a podcast. I have these headband earphones, which if you don't have those, get a pair. They're on Amazon and they're really cheap. They're comfy to sleep in, and you can listen to podcasts as you drift off. And then when I get up, I have to put the same episode on in the car on the way to work so I can actually listen to the story. Anyways, I'm going to be back again next week with either more of Cindy's story or my Intimate Partner Homicide June installment. We are going to eventually get to the bottom of this one. As always, thank you so much for listening.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.